Several years ago, I attended a moderated discussion with the playwright Robert Schenken. Earlier the same day, I won an award for a short play I wrote, and I was feeling pretty good about myself. During his discussion, Schenken went into detail about the process in creating his plays, The Kentucky Cycle and All the Way, particularly the sprawling nature and duration of them. As he was talking, I started to realize how small I think with my own work. The scope and scale of my plays were always so limited because I thought I had some idea of what made plays producible. They needed to be 90 minutes, they needed to have simple production elements, the cast had to call for six or fewer actors. The funny thing was, my plays weren't getting produced, so why was I putting all these parameters on my work? The piece I wrote that had me feeling all special before Schenken had me questioning my fortitude was about a soldier going AWOL during the war in Iraq. It won a thing, and somebody called it my calling card play, so to me, that was all I needed to know. But I couldn't help thinking about the Kentucky Cycle, and the story spread through time. What if I allowed myself to think more broadly about my plays? What if I stopped concerning myself with producibility and started writing the plays the way they needed to be written? I kept coming back to that little Iraq War play I wrote. I decided to explode it over a series of years in order to tell a fuller and deeper story about the pathways for young people into the military and what happens to the young unformed mind when it is sent off to war. It has not been easy. I learned a great challenge in writing what is essentially durational theater all by yourself is you lose sight of all the moving parts. You can't always keep up with the images and motifs planted in the early or mid portions of the play, and the narrative can easily go awry. I mean, there are a million challenges to any play I write, but I found the idea of building this play to be unbelievably cumbersome. I mean, I'm not setting out to write Angels in America or The Kentucky Cycle. I'm just giving myself the freedom to think bigger. Not every play needs to be epic and sprawling, but sometimes a play needs that kind of space to realize itself. The real change for me has come in eradicating the idea of what is producible, because producibility is really in the eye of the beholder. Welcome to The Subtext, a podcast where this playwright talks to other playwrights and tries to crack the code of what it means to do this thing we do. I am the host, Brian James Polak. This month's guest is Lee Edward Colston II, author of The First Deep Breath, which just opened at Victory Gardens in Chicago. Just opened if you are listening to this episode in November of 2019. The Subtext is brought to you by American Theatre Magazine, a program of Theatre Communications Group, and I am eternally grateful to American Theatre and TCG for keeping the lights on at the Subtext World Headquarters because I love doing this podcast and hope to keep doing it for a very long time. To that end, if you're interested in continuing to hear me talk to wonderful playwrights into the future, please do all the things like rate and comment on the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you grab your pods, and share the episodes with people in your life. The more people who listen, the more likely it is we'll be able to churn out more episodes into the future. If you want to connect with us on the social medias, go to @subtextpodcast on Twitter. And if you have a burning desire to say something longer than Twitter allows, send an email to thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. All right. Lee Colston is a playwright and an actor from Philadelphia. If you're a TV viewer, you may have caught him on The Blacklist and Mr. Robot. If you're in Chicago in November, December of 2019, you can catch his play The First Deep Breath at Victory Gardens. Lee and I talk a lot about his past work as a prison guard, what it means to have your first professional production on such a big stage, and finding people to support your dream in the least likely place. Lee and I recorded this conversation in early November in Che Yu's office at Victory Gardens in Chicago. I don't think Che knew we were there, so thanks, Che.
Funny.
I mean, do you feel like you've got something to say?
I mean, I got plenty to say, bro.
there's a lot, right? There's a lot. The world's a lot right now.
There are a lot of things happening in the world right now, and I have a lot of thoughts on a lot of things. but it's just interesting to me that, like, this... That's, like, you know, that certain publications are, like, even interested in, like, you know, listening to what I, you know, to what I have to say about things.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me just I find really ironic.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Why is that? Like, what do you, are you saying like about you, about yourself personally?
I think myself personally, like I don't know. Like, I think like for the space that I occupy as an artist and an activist and like striking a balance between those two, I try to, you know, speak the truth wherever I can.
Yeah.
You know, my version of it, if you will.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes to like, you know, what this play is about.
Mm-hmm.
I write in like the, you know, like one of those, thoughts from the playwright things that they put in, the play
into the program. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, like I wrote this thing and it's not something that I came up with, but just something I read or heard somewhere. But it's like that, anything that can be destroyed with a compassionate truth should be, because whatever it is probably built on lies. And
wow.
And so, Americans, we love our lies. We love our lies. And I try to live my life and, create my art in a way that challenges and burns down as many lies as I can.
I literally just saw, and I have terrible memory recall when I see things, but I just saw a cartoon online a couple hours ago. Like this just happened, and it said, I'll probably get it wrong, but it said artists tell lies to reveal the truth. Politicians tell lies to hide the truth.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this whole experience is just weird to me. Everything going on with this play, and then like, you know, this like mantle of like playwright that the American theater kind of like, you know, like when people talk about playwrights, that it has this like thing to be revered.
There's this weight to it.
It
yeah.
does, and I'm like, I think that's the thing that feels weird to me. Because this is my first world premiere.
Yeah.
And so really understanding what that is, what it means to others, but more importantly, figuring out what does it mean to me?
Right. What does it mean to you? Because we're at a pretty prestigious theater, yeah. right? In one of the great theater cities in the world.
Country, yeah.
And this is your first professional production.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean it is, and also like, you know, like the idea of being a writer or being, you know, I even translate that into like, you know, to being a griot, like what does that mean to me, and then what's the responsibility that comes with that?
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel empowered and challenged and inspired to write the things that people are afraid to talk about or don't know how to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
A good friend of mine, he's a poet, an activist. His name is Greg Corbin. He goes by Just Greg Corbin, which is like his performance poetry.
Just Greg Corbin?
Just Greg is what
he
goes
just
by.
Greg.
He's a real, real dope brother.
Okay.
But he said this thing to me one time, and I'm probably going to like butcher this a little bit, but it kind of stuck. And he was like, don't, like when you're looking to tell a story or to share your story, don't look for the stories in the cathedral of your heart. Like look for the stories in the alleyways of your heart behind the dumpster next to the 40 bottle halfway filled with piss. Cause that's where your real stories live. And I was like, huh.
Man.
Yeah. It's like, isn't that cool?
God, I mean, to me, that's saying go to those places you don't want to go to.
You don't want to go to. Or go to the places that at first seem like trash or seem like something to be discarded or seem like something to be hidden. Like, don't just go to the, you know, to the places in your heart that are pristine.
Yeah.
You know, don't just go to the door, you know, to the rooms in your heart to look for stories that you've been in and out of, you know, for, you know, a lifetime.
Yeah.
Where are the undiscovered parts of you?
Yeah.
And then be willing to investigate those places.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is why I write, you know, like I am constantly working on myself, and the things that I discover about myself, you know, I find a way to, I don't know, to create work from it.
Yeah.
You know, there were something I learned in grad school, with one of my teachers. He gave it, there was like these three, quotes that he gave us in like our like first year acting class.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, and I don't remember who coined these quotes, so forgive me, but the first one was like, every word is a decision. And I was like,
that makes
perfect sense for me as a writer. The second one was, a poem is a suppressed scream. And I was like, okay. And then the third one, which I do remember who quoted this one, this was a Lorca quote, and it was that a play is a poem standing up. And so, and these were, I didn't get these quotes all at one time.
Right.
But they were like,
they're collecting.
Yeah. It was just like, you know, like one class, he was like, oh, a poem is a, and excuse me, every word is a decision. And it was like, every word on the page is a decision that a writer made. I was like, great, that makes sense. It's like, oh, and a poem is a suppressed scream. Ooh, that's really juicy. And like,
yeah.
So then every word you've decided to go onto the page lends itself to this scream being suppressed. And then if a play is a poem standing up, then I was like, oh, well, thinking about those three things in relationship to one another, you know, gave me a lot of food as a writer.
Did you... So you went to grad school for acting. Had you been writing before you went to grad school?
Yeah. I wrote one of my first plays. Well, I wrote my first play while I was working in the prison system as a corrections officer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote my second play while I was in undergrad at University Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I started First Deep Breath when I was a first year at Juilliard.
There are, so you're an, I don't know if you describe yourself this way, so pardon me if I'm getting you wrong, but you are a person who lives in the acting world and the writing world, right? You perform, you write. And I've interviewed a bunch of playwrights who still do both, or started off as an actor, became a writer, or maybe flip-flop back and forth. But you are probably the only playwright that I've heard of, it may be the only one in America who is a former corrections officer as well.
Maybe. I don't know.
That really popped to me when I saw that in your bio, because I visited a prison a couple times with an acting company in Southern California to just witness their acting class with these men in prison. And it was like this mind-blowing experience for me, and it's a world that we tend to only learn through film and television, so we don't see what it's really like. And just the experience of walking into a prison and through a prison yard and being in a room with inmates was the most mind-blowing experience of my life, and it sort of changed me in a way that I found empathy in a way that I never thought.
We have these preconceived notions of what human beings who are incarcerated are like.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that we forget is that they are human beings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I started working in the prison system when I was a teenager because my father was a corrections officer. And he got me a job, you know, some kids, you know, work at McDonald's, and I ended up working in a commissary. And I was like, you know, my dad, like in retrospect, that was one of my father's ways of just keeping me close.
Yeah.
You know, as his son. But I learned, cause I worked, you know, shoulder to shoulder with these men. You know, some guys were my age or younger, and some guys were old enough to be my great-grandfather. And I think the thing that has been an incredible asset to me as an actor and as a writer is that working in corrections, working in the prison, I've had the privilege of meeting every man that I will ever play or write about. Like literally thousands of guys, all from, you know, various experiences and economic backgrounds and cultures, or, you know, just anybody you can dream up. I've had the privilege, and I do consider it a privilege, to have seen some of the most generous acts of humanity and vulnerability and softness in one of the most unlikeliest of places, and also some of the ugliest acts of humanity, you know? And sometimes the ugly would come from people who were in uniform, and the generosity would come from people who were incarcerated. And then sometimes those roles would swap, you know? So like, but I got to see up close and at a young age, what does humanity look like at its stress point? And to be able to absorb and to think about those things, you know?
When you started there as a teenager, was it already sort of demystified for you? Was it normalized because your dad did this work? Or was it, when you started, were you like, this place is crazy, man?
I remember, because I was working in a relatively newer facility, like a facility that had been, at that time, I guess it had been built within like the first 10 years or so. So it was a relatively new institution. And I remember thinking, I didn't know what I was walking into. And then just like, you know people, you know how to deal with people. So just deal with people. And, you know, coming from North Philly and growing up in the hood, like there was just a vocabulary and agility I had with dealing with folks like that. It's like, oh, I know you. You're like, you know, you could have grown up across the street from me, or, you know, I could have gone to high school with you. There was a guy who was locked up at my jail who did grow up across the street from me. And this dude, he used to bully me incessantly growing up. And we had this experience where, like, he knew what our relationship was, like, you know, when I was growing up. And so, like, now that the power dynamic has shifted, he was expecting me to just, like, you know,
give it back
and get vengeance on
him. So he saw you and knew who you were, remembered who you were.
We saw each other, and we were, you know, I've known him most of his life.
Yeah.
You know, and vice versa. And we weren't friends. Or
right. Yeah.
It was just
yeah.
like, you know, some dude who used to just, you know, fuck with me from time to time.
Yeah.
And so I saw him, and then, you know, I didn't say anything to him. I let him be. But then, you know, the institution is only but so big, and you can't really get away from each other. And so, like, one day he's like coming from the chow line, inmate cafeteria. And I stop him in the hall, you know, to do a pat down, because you have to do a certain amount of pat downs every day. And he was like, oh, here we go. I knew this was coming.
Meaning you?
Yeah.
Like you're.
Yeah.
I
knew this moment was going to happen. Yeah, okay. He knew that like one day I was going to like exact my revenge, you know, for, you know, him.
Yeah.
You know, bullying me or whatever. And, you know, I just kept it really classy and really professional, you know.
Did you acknowledge him? Did you call him by name?
I did. I know you, bro. Like, yeah. I know who he was.
Yeah.
And, you know, in that moment, like, you know, patted him down. He was waiting for me to, like, you know, he's waiting for the other shoe to drop. And then I just asked him, it's like, how you holding up?
Yeah.
You know, and he kind of looked at me weird. It was like, you know, it's like, you know, just keep your head up, man. Like, I know things are hard for you in here. Just keep your head up.
Yeah.
And that really surprised him. And it was like, yeah, man, I'm like, I'm not here to like exact, that's just not who I am as a person.
Right.
You know, like I could be petty, but why?
Right.
Like karma has literally like, you know, worked itself out. And I don't need that kind of justice. That is not justice to me.
Yeah.
And I also recognize, and maybe I didn't understand it intellectually then, but like we're all carrying, you know, a certain amount of demons and ghosts with us, and there's trauma that we've all inherited, you know, him included. You know, is he any less deserving of empathy or humanity?
Right.
Because he made a mistake? I don't think so. You know, like, I think he's just as deserving as anybody else is. You know, we just had, you know, we had a little moment, you know, to just check in, you know, and ask him, like, you know, how his mom is doing, because his mother lived down the street from my parents' house at the time.
Yeah.
And just kept it really, you know.
And did it classic. Change him? Like, did you recognize it?
I could literally see a weight lift, you know, off his shoulders. Like, I could tell that he was waiting for me to harm him.
Yeah.
And not necessarily physically, but just like being, you know, doing whatever.
You've got the power. So
the power dynamic is uneven, right? Yeah. You know, so like, and that's just not my MO. It never has been. I try to move through the world in a way where it's like, I want to leave a mark, but I don't want to leave a scar.
Mm.
You know, and so, and I ask myself that, you know, on a regular basis, like, am I about to leave a mark here, or am I going to leave a scar here?
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I'm leaving a scar, and I need to like be honest with myself about that, you know, and like strive to do better. And I don't always get it right. You know, sometimes I get it wrong. But I try to get it right, you know, as many times as I can.
Yeah.
Or try to get it true, mm-hmm. rather. And I try to lean into kindness and generosity, because that's how I would want somebody to treat me.
Where do you think this comes from in you? Like, did you become a person like this through your own sort of self-reflection, or were you like, as a kid, were you always this sort of empathetic and self-reflective?
It's come from a lot of work. A lot of work that I've been doing on myself, mm-hmm. over the past few years. I think being an actor has helped, mm-hmm. tremendously. I feel like my art has saved my life a lot, more times than one, you know?
Yeah.
I have this idea about this kind of like personal life mantra about interrogating my inheritances and what those things are. I think as human beings, we all have an inheritance, mm-hmm. that is passed on to us culturally, socially. Even as citizens of the same country, you know, we have our individual American inheritances.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, you know, unpacking, just because you inherit something doesn't mean you have to keep it. Doesn't mean that it's useful to you. If you inherit something, there may be a tax on it, you know, and if you're not aware of what that tax is, it can harm you or the people around you. Part of unpacking my inheritance is about really interrogating my intention versus my impact.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes my intent and impact are in alignment, and sometimes it's not. And I got to be brave enough to sort through that, you know?
When you were a teenager, you get to work in the prison system, your dad brings you in. Were you thinking this was a potential, like, life for you, like a career?
Absolutely not.
Was this just a job to earn a little money?
It was something that I didn't want to do at all.
Yeah.
Like, I had zero interest in working in corrections.
Mm-hmm.
I went to community college of Philly, started out, you know, in the theater program there.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know about actor training or anything like that. I just knew, like, you know, I saw a production of For Colored Girls when I was a teenager and sat in a theater, and it kicked me in the chest. It was so beautiful and powerful. And I saw these women, these black women who looked like my mother and my aunt and my sisters and my grandmother, share their stories. And I don't want to say like burned. I don't know if that's the right word, but like it planted a seed of empathy in me.
Yeah.
For these women who actually, up until that point, had never actually really taken the time to consider their humanity and what we as black men do to them. And yet they still love us. Even when we're not at our best, they still love us. Right. And I was like, man, that kind of empathy is...
How old were you?
I think I was like 15 or 16, something like
what,
that.
What brought you to that theater? Like, what... Was this your first theatrical experience?
That's my very first play I I saw, the very first theatrical experience I had was watching a production of For Color Girls.
So how did you find yourself in the audience of that show?
I don't really remember. I think a friend of mine, a mentor of mine, took me out to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
And just invited me to come, and I went, and mm-hmm. it was a free ticket.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why I'm like, theater needs to be accessible, because you just don't know who you're blocking out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just remember sitting in this tiny theater, watching these women work, and it changed me. And then I got to meet them afterwards, and they were just the loveliest women in the world.
Yeah.
And I went home that day and sat my parents down and had like a really serious, you know, 16-year-old conversation. It was like, I have decided what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, and I'm going to be an actor.
Really?
Yeah. And
it was that immediate?
That immediate, yeah. I knew. Wow. I knew then. And my parents were like, wow. You know, they were like, okay. They were really kind. You know, in the
way that this is cute.
Yeah, like, you know, in the way that, like, when any 16-year-old, you know, tells you, I have decided what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, right. I knew then, and it has not changed since. And circling back to your original question about, like, did I, you know, was correction something that I wanted to do or go into? It wasn't. But my father at the time, you know, you got to do something. And I was like, well, I want to be an actor. It's like, well, how are you going to eat? I was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do this. And there's nobody in my community that I could look to see a roadmap. You look at these artists on TV, like the Denzel Washingtons and the Viola Davises, and you see these people who are famous, but they feel so far away.
Mm.
And then, you know, this is like pre-YouTube era, where you could, like, you know, look up interviews and whatnot. This was just, I had zero clue on how to make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so my father, being the pragmatic man that he is, was like, you know, well, you're going to go take the civil service test, and then you're going to come and, you know, work at the jail so that way you can, you know, you can make a living.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And being a dutiful son, I did.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't what I wanted to do, but it was like, what else was I supposed to do? And I didn't know that there were places you could go to train as an actor. I had zero idea that existed. I remember, like, when I went to undergrad, which is like, I went to this spot I trained at University of Arts in Philly. And I remember being so frustrated with the school, because I was like, this place has been here the whole time. I live in this city. Why have I never heard of it?
Yeah.
You know, why didn't anybody tell me
right.
that there was a place, you know, that there was a place for me? And I mean, it's like part of my gripe, you know, with the American theater as a whole, about like, we don't really do community outreach to let people know that we exist. The only people that we do more often than not community outreach to are older white folks.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, I wish that I had known about these places. Like, what if I had found out about these places sooner? I snuck into the back of the theater here at Victory Gardens. They were doing a community theater production of A Raisin in the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rehearsing. I mean, that play was going up right across the hall from where we're rehearsing. And it was like these two plays in conversation with one another, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the woman's name who directed and self-produced the play. And I just sat in the back of the theater and watched, and I just thought it was so powerful. This production with, you know, just like people within the community feeling an ownership over this piece of material. And the audience was all, you know, was nothing but black folks in there. Mm-hmm. And this thing that was like that felt like their cultural heirloom that they were sharing amongst themselves. And mm-hmm. I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah.
And I literally thought, I was like, man, I hope, you know, one of my plays can do that one day.
Yeah.
You know, that 50 years later, it's still being in conversation, you know, where people feel like that this belongs to them.
Yeah, and it is incredible. I mean, that's a play, you know, that's a Chicago play, and it's a Chicago story, but it is in, you know, truly an American story, and it's mm-hmm. incredible how resonant it is. Mm-hmm. 50 years, it's sad how resonant it is still 50 years later.
Yeah, I hope. I mean, it's my hope. I'm sure, like, you know, the same hope with any playwright, you know, hopes that their material will be relevant, you know, mm-hmm. outside of their own lifetime. And I hope that this play can be, like a raisin in the sun for the 21st century.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I was on Facebook and I read this article written by the assistant of one of my favorite writers, Robert Greene. She was, you know, like, just talking about her time, like, you know, working with this prolific writer, and he wrote, like, you know, the 48 Laws of Power and the 33 Strategies of War and the Art of Seduction and these books that really interrogate history and finds themes through history. Mm-hmm. And he breaks them down in this, like, really specific ways, like, super cool if you haven't read it. But she asked him about, like, you know, like, how do you write something that stands the test of time? And I'm paraphrasing, but I mean, she said that he had said to her that people try to write hits, you know, as opposed to trying to write the classic.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, well, you know, how do you write a classic? You know, do you really get to say if something is going to be a classic? And he's like, no, I guess. He's like, no, you can design that. You can design something to be a classic. And she's like, well, how do you do that? And he said to her, write about the things that will not change.
Mm.
You know, write about the things that will stay relevant, you know, forever. You know, it's how many of the themes in Raisin in the Sun sadly are still relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
It's why we're still doing Shakespeare, you know. It's why August Wilson's plays will, you know, live on for generations and generations and generations. And so I thought about that in the crafting of First Deep Breath, and I was like, well, I don't want to try to write a hit. I want to write a classic. I want to write something that I think will outlive me, and outlive, you know, everyone, hopefully.
This is something you're conscious of as something you are setting out to write the play.
Yeah, super conscious of. And I was thinking, like, well, in order to do that, what are the things that will not change? And I was like, well, family, you know, is forever, mm-hmm. you know? As long as there are humans, there will be families. And, you know, so then what are the things in families that will not change? You know, parents and their children will often misunderstand one another. Losing loved ones and dealing with grief will never change.
Mm-hmm.
Falling in love or falling out of love will never change. Mm-hmm. Humans will always do that. We will always interrogate our beliefs and question our beliefs and what's important to us, and those things will change. Fathers and sons will beef with one another sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mothers and sons, you know, will beef. Mothers and daughters will beef. Daughters and mothers, you know, like, these things don't change. And they then become universal.
Mm-hmm.
And so then thinking about my own experiences being a part of a family. And so then I'm able to ask questions about, like, well, what are the things that left marks on me, and what are the things that left scars?
Mm-hmm.
And then use that as a jumping off point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I got the initial idea, I read this newspaper article about this father and son who got into this conflict, and it ended really, really tragically. And I remember asking myself, I was like, how did that happen? Like, what were the steps that led up to
mm-hmm.
this?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, my brain started cooking, and then I called, you know, one of my friends and asked her, like, you know, like, I think I got this crazy idea. You know, I think I want to write, you know, an epic.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, dope, go write it. As best friends I wanted to do. You know, and I didn't, like, you know, I started it, but then couldn't finish it. Like, I started, and I think I got, like, maybe 30 or 40 pages in, and then I just could not finish it. And then it sat in a file, you know, on my computer for years.
I want to jump back and then circle back to this point, mm-hmm. to the point where this play was put in a drawer for a while. You go to see For Colored Girls. You have this epiphany. You make the statement to your parents, and then a couple years later, you find yourself at community college,
mm-hmm.
right? Like so that's essentially, and you start taking theater classes for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
At what point do you start to think, I want to tell my own story and I want to start writing?
I don't know if that was the epiphany of like, I want to tell my own story.
What eventually got you to the point where you're like, I want to write, like I'm going to act in plays, but I've got something I want to say myself.
I actually don't even know if I had that realization. Not until later. Because I was too afraid to talk about myself and my own experience.
Why are you afraid? Are you afraid? Are you acting? Were you acting because you wanted to be part of the theater, but you wanted to hide inside a character?
I actually don't even think I had that type of self-awareness to even understand that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
I remember what I felt sitting in the seats and how transformative that was for me. And I thought, I want to be a part of helping other people to feel like that.
Having that experience, that yeah. impact on somebody else sitting in an audience.
Yeah. It was like, I thought, I want to do that for people. Because it really just like changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was also like, I don't think it was a production that was a part of like somebody sees. And I think it was very much like that production of A Raisin in the Sun that I saw, like, you know, somebody decided to produce it and put it up.
Put it on.
And put it on. And I just so happened to be sitting in the audience and it really rocked my world.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, I was like, I want to do that for other people. Because if this changed my life this way, then what might it do for somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to be a part. I just wanted to be a part of something like that.
So you started to do this. You go to college and you start to do
well,
this.
Even before that, I went on and off. Like, so that planted that seed in me. But, you know, as a teenager, like, you know, you get inspired by one thing and then it kind of goes away for a little bit.
Sure, yeah.
And so one of my friends from high school, he was like, I'm going to be an actor. I want to be an actor. And he, that was the coolest thing in the world. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. But, like, I don't know if I actually really want to do that yet. I know how I feel. I felt in that moment, but I actually don't know if I have the courage to do that. And he invited me to go with him, me, him, and another friend of mine who started out as a playwright with this program in Philadelphia called Philadelphia Young Playwrights, which is probably one of the most important and impactful experiences of my young artistic life.
Mm-hmm.
As I learned, it planted the seed then that my voice mattered. And when you're growing up, you know, Black and in Philadelphia, in a community that is just deprived of resources and is poor, you know, like you don't, it's easy to believe that your voice doesn't matter. And so that program helped to teach me that what I had to say was important.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not learned that lesson before. I had learned to keep my head down and try to get whatever you can. As opposed to reaching for what you want,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, like, it's one of the building blocks of, like, you know, changing my thinking from trying to survive to looking for opportunities and creating opportunities to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
Which for, you know, a Black teenager in Philly was huge for me. It was like huge for me.
So what got you over the hump? You had this friend who was ready to go, and you were like, I'm not ready yet.
Yeah, like,
what got you there?
So I went with him to, like, you know, just to go hang out and to be supportive. He was going to go audition for a play at this theater company downtown. I hung out with him. We were sitting in the lobby. He went in, he auditioned. And then I'm sitting in the lobby with my boy. And then he comes out And then the director comes out with him and he's like, looks at me. He's like, oh, are you here to audition? I was like, oh, no. I'm not an actor. It's like, I just came here to support my friend.
Right. Yeah.
And he's like, well, would you consider coming in and reading for me? And it was like, oh, no, it's like, it's not my thing. It's like, I'm not an actor.
Right. Right.
And so then my boys are like, no, go do it. You know, like, oh, stop being scared. And they kind of dared me and peer pressured me into it because I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to be scared, you know. Mm-hmm. So I went in and I auditioned for the play and I got the job.
Get out.
Yeah, which wasn't...
Friend get it?
No.
Oh, are you serious? Oh, my God.
And so, and I thought that, like, he would be upset about it. And he was kind of, he was a little bit, but not really. He was just like, okay, you know, congrats.
Yeah.
And then I got to do that as, like, you know, one of my first teenage jobs, you know? Mm-hmm. And I thought... I was just like, you know, doing it just because, and then I got a paycheck at the end of the week. You know, I was like, what's this for? And it was like, oh, it's just like your pay, you know, for the work you did. I was like, wait, we get paid for this? I had no idea that you know, that I was supposed to like get a paycheck or anything.
I mean,
like that.
You don't always get one.
No, so. you don't always get one. And so, but because I had zero relationship to the theater.
Right, yeah.
Or thinking of it as a job. I thought it was just this fun thing that we got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, oh, wait, people get paid for this? Oh, I'm sold.
Yeah.
Little did I know. little did I know, man. But, like that was like one of the turning points. But the thing that kind of like unlocked things for me as a writer is when I took the job working in corrections, you know, trying to be a dutiful son. I couldn't audition. I couldn't do anything. I had auditioned for Juilliard at that point and didn't get in. I got called back, but didn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had all this creative actor energy that I wanted to get out of me and it had nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I was sitting on a cell block and one of the guys who was locked up on my unit, I guess he was having a really bad day and he was just pacing in this small corner of the unit, just pacing back and forth. And I watched him pace for like an hour. I just remember like watching how caged he looked.
Mm-hmm.
And I grabbed a pen and a notepad that was nearby and I just started writing. And I wrote a poem. And I'd never really considered myself a poet.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that point. And I wrote this poem called The Lion. And there was something in writing that piece that unlocked this floodgate in my brain. And so one poem turned into five, and five turned into 50, and 50 turned into like maybe 270 poems in the course of one summer. It just like, you know, this floodgate of like expression just kind of started to pour out of me. And then those poems eventually turned into, it's like, well, why don't I write a play? And then I wrote this, you know, and I wrote one of my first plays. And while I was writing, like, you know, I would have, you know, like guys who were locked up on my block, they'd like, oh, what are you working on? It's like, oh, I'm just writing this thing. And I wrote it out by hand mostly.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, can I read it? And I would let some of them read it. And, you know, and they would read it and they were like, yo, man, this really moved me. And that was really, you know, it was really, really powerful. And that, you know, just encouraged me, you know. Like there was one guy who was locked up on my block. Well, actually, no, not even one. There were a couple of guys who I remember. One dude's name was Antonio Rivera. Another dude's name was Donald Scott. Another dude's name was Khalil Amaker, and another dude's name was Santana Bellinger. Like, and even like all young Black and Latinx men, and we would talk. And I share it with them one day, like they would share their stories with me. And then, you know, when you share stories, you feel, you know, compelled to share your own.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm like 21 and I share it with them. It's like, what do you like? You're too smart to be here, Coast. Like, what do you want to like? Why are you here? Like, you're not like, you know, these other COs. Like, why are you here.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, it's a job. And it's like, what do you really want to do? And I was like, well, you know, I really want to be an artist. I really want to be an actor. And it's like, well, you got to get out of here. You know, you can't do this. So what are you doing, like, you know, to try to get to that goal?
Yeah.
And it's like, ah, you know, I don't really know. And so like, well, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to hold you accountable. And I'm going to remind you every day, you know, that you're supposed to be an actor. You're not supposed to be a CO. And these mofos, like, every day that I would come in, one, if not all of them, would be like, see, you still a CO and not an actor. You know, like, so, like, you know, what'd you do today to, you know, to try to get toward that, get closer to your goal? And they, like, you know, I mean, using shame tactics, but still it was effective nonetheless.
Yeah, and but like, you've got, like, these inmates are your accountability buddies.
They really were.
Like, that's they, awesome.
They really were so encouraging, you know, like, when I auditioned for Juilliard the second time, I didn't really tell many people. But they knew, and so they would ask me, like, how's your audition coming? I know you know when you're not here, you're working on that, so how's that going? And just, like, you know, and it just kept me, I felt like I was being held accountable. But then the irony is, when I would share these things with officers, you know, they would, you know, just be like, I remember one dude, you know, that I worked with, that really, like, hurt my feelings, you know, and I shared, like, you know, my dream. It was like, but Lee, you're a CO. And he, like, laughed at me, like, full belly, like, laughed. And was like, yeah, like, he's like, I used to have a dream too, you know, I used to want to be a drummer, you know, but then I grew the fuck up. And he, like, you know, like, dreams is for kids, you know, like, you know, I'm gonna make a bet with you, you know, like, I'm gonna check in with you in 5 years, you know, in 5 years when you're still here, you know, I'm gonna remind you that we had this, you know, this conversation. And that, like, crushed me, because I believed for a second, not even for a second, I was like, what if he's right? What if I'm chasing, like, a pipe dream, you know? And then, like, you know, there's another guy, like, you know, the play that I had written while I was working at the jail, I was like, I think I want to put this thing up one day. And he was like, you want to, like, direct it? And I was like, yeah. I was like, produce and direct it, why not? And he was like, you're a CO. It's like, come on, man. Like, you know, you grow up. Yeah. And I was just like, and he's like, I mean, I'm being the sensitive person that I was. These things crushed me. I didn't show that, you know.
Right, yeah.
You know, because I was trying to be macho or whatever. But like, but yeah, but those things, like, really crushed me. And I started to believe, like, damn, what if they're right? But those things taught me, you don't share your dreams with everybody. You're not supposed to. Your dreams are written in a language only you can understand. And when you try to speak your language to someone who does not understand the mother tongue of your heart, you know, then what do you expect to happen?
Yeah.
You know? People aren't going to people are just not going to understand.
Yeah.
And what people don't understand, they reject. That's just human nature. But I didn't know that as a 21-year-old. And yeah, that, like, those moments, like, really.
Those guys were talking to themselves.
They really were. Like,
that's what was really happening in that moment. And the same thing with those, with the inmates who were supporting you. Like,
yeah, they were talking about that. They were like, go live up to your potential because we didn't.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Yeah, they were like, you know, they were instrumental. And being, like, you know, people who kept me encouraged, you know. And granted, like, you know, like, they, you know, in there for a whole host of different crimes.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's not saying that, like, you know, that they didn't have things that they were, you know, they were struggling with or working through as people, you know, like, people, you know, incarcerated inside of this larger system. But human to human, and it's really terse experience, they chose to speak to me at a time where I needed to hear something like that. And it came from the most unlikeliest of sources. And I will be forever grateful, you know, to them for doing that.
Yeah.
At the time, like, they didn't know how much it meant to me to have that accountability and that encouragement. But it meant the world to me, and it shifted my perspective on a lot of things. And then also, like, they didn't, it was never like our relationship was never inappropriate. You know, there was never like, they never asked for like favors or anything out of mutual respect.
Yeah.
It was like, we're never going to put you in a position to compromise your job as an officer. We understand that you are here to incarcerate us.
Yeah.
But they saw my humanity past my uniform, and that challenged me to see their humanity past their uniform.
And man, isn't that the thing? Like, we want to be seen, right? Yeah. Like, we want people to see us. Yeah. And you'd think your colleagues would be the people doing like the same, living this similar life, doing the same job. Mm-hmm. They'd be the ones that would recognize, but no.
Yeah, I mean, my brother, who was also an officer at the institution too at the time, he was one of my accountability partners, and like really challenged me to like, it's like, you say you're going to do this thing, so you're going to do it.
Yeah,
you know, I'm gonna beat you up, and like, you know, like he really helped me he protected me. Like my big brother protected me.
Yeah.
Because he could, you know, he knew I was sensitive. He's always known that I've been the sensitive one.
Right, right.
He was always will be one of my biggest cheerleaders, you know, to like, yo, go do the thing that you know you're supposed to do. Go be the thing you know you're supposed to be. And you don't have to ask anybody's permission for that. And that was the thing that I didn't know as a kid that I know now.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, you don't have to ask permission to be yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta set those boundaries and trust that you are enough. And that's a hard lesson to learn.
Yeah. Some people never get that.
No, some people don't. I'm still learning. I think you always are working on that. You know?
We're running out of time. So I want to circle back to where we were before. You were talking about how you started to write this play. You got 30 or 40 pages in. So you eventually get to Juilliard, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, many years
you
later.
You follow through.
three tries later.
But you make it happen, mm-hmm. right? You keep at it, and you eventually get there, which is awesome.
Well, here's the funny thing. So I didn't even know Juilliard existed until, and I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but like I had no idea that Juilliard existed until I saw the movie Save the Last Dance. And so, like, I went to go see this movie, and I was like, oh, shit, this is cool, you know?
Right.
And it was like, oh, this is, like, you know, I was like, this is cool. You know, like, what is Juilliard?
Right,
I had no idea.
Right.
It was like, so then I remember going home and, like, looking it up on the internet, and it was like, oh, like, some of the greatest actors in the world have trained at this place.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that I want to be one of the greatest actors in the world, so that's where I'm supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it literally was just like, that's just where I'm supposed to be. And then, you know, like, I've applied to Juilliard at this point 5 times. So I applied 3 times as an actor and twice as a playwright.
Yeah.
You are only, as an actor, you're only allowed to audition twice. And so there was a loophole that I was able to utilize when they created the MFA program.
Uh-huh.
And so I ended up becoming a part of the inaugural MFA program.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of my friends, after I'd applied to the acting program twice, I was like, oh, well, that's it. I can't audition anymore. And then I applied once as a playwright and didn't get in. I was like, okay, so now I'm definitely done.
Yeah.
Because that institution has made it abundantly clear that I'm not supposed to be there. And then one of my friends, my friend and collaborator, Malika Oyetiman, I was her assistant director on a musical that she was directing. And she had put the bug in my ear to to apply. You know, she's like, you should apply again. I was like, oh no, that is not for me. I'm not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
She was like, no, I think you should do it. And she all but threatened me with violence to throw my hat in the ring again.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was like, you know, what needs to be done? Do I need to pay your application fees? Do I need to help you fill out, you know, your essays? Like, what needs to be done so you can get this done? And she, you know, because she is a tiny woman who is very persuasive, I did it. And then during that time, I prepared, you know, in a different way. And this was like many years away from the first two times I had applied.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up getting in this time. And it changed my, the trajectory of my life.
Yeah.
And it just offered me, you know, more tools. And so while I was there, the germs or the seed for the first deep breath were planted. I was just in a different space to be able to think about things differently.
Mm-hmm.
But I ran into that writer's block, you know, that really trapped and paralyzed this play. And I was trying so hard to get this play out of me, and it just would not, you know, it just refused, you know, to be born. And I was trying to figure out why that was. And then I had this epiphany, and I was like, Oli, you can't finish this play because you're not ready to be honest with yourself yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, fuck. You know, like, you want to write something really cool.
Was that self-discovery?
It was self-discovery, yeah. You want to write something cool, but you don't want to write something true.
Yeah.
And so then I had to ask myself, well, why am I not ready to be honest? And there were a couple of things. One, I was still living in a space of really being worried about what other people might think of my story, of me, of my experiences, and sharing, deeply personal parts of myself, and like really running up into that space of like, am I enough? And that's really hard to sort through, mm-hmm. you know? I know I definitely, you know, struggle with insecurity and, you know, like as an artist and as a person, and, you know, like as something that I strive to remedy, and like, you know, really waking up every morning and choosing myself, you know, not just my work, you know, and making sure that my work is not, that my worth is not a slave to my work,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know? And so mm-hmm. that like, that I'm not placing, like if people like this thing that I make, that I am now, that I am worthy of something.
Yeah.
Or if I get into this, you know, this school that I really wanted, that I am worthy of something. And I think that's probably the thing, when I auditioned for the program and eventually got in, it meant less to me. And it was just like, I'm actually just doing this for myself and not doing it to try to win anything.
Mm-hmm.
And First Deep Breath got written that way. I didn't think that anybody would ever produce this play. I just needed to write something that I thought would be the key to helping myself heal and to self-repair.
And has it?
Yeah. Writing this play has changed my life inside and out. It's changed my life. It's changed the course of my career. It has been a lesson for myself in the power of making a choice to heal, and the power of that what I've inherited, I don't have to carry. You know, this flight called life is expensive, and you don't have to carry all the bags that you're handed. Checking these bags are expensive. So you need to sort through and make sure that everything that you are carrying on this flight called life belongs to you.
Mm.
And I had to figure out, like, you know, that what belongs to me and what doesn't. What are the things that, like, I am in pursuit of my dream, you know, of my various dreams of, like, you know, being able to make a living as an artist. And am I carrying baggage that is actually getting in the way of that? And the only way you can figure that out is through self-reflection, is through therapy, you know, being able to really sharpen my emotional intelligence. The work of Brené Brown and daring greatly and braving the wilderness and you know, all of her, any, you know, everything that she's written has been life-changing for me as an artist and as a human being. And it's given me a vocabulary to be surgically incisive within my own self and my own spirit and psyche, and really refining my emotional intelligence and emotional maturity, which are not, I had to learn, which are not the same thing, mm-hmm. which then changed my work. It just offered me a vocabulary and a toolbox to be able to get really real with myself about, like, okay, here are the things you say you want for yourself. Are you in alignment with that? Are you making choices that are lending itself to that? Are you repairing the traumas that you've inherited,
mm-hmm.
And making peace with those things? Do you like you? Because you can't create, you know, if you don't like you. At least that's how I feel, you know, like I can't create if I don't like myself.
And where are you with that now? Do you yourself?
I love myself. Nice. You know, I love who I am. I love the person that I'm becoming. I love the best parts of my inheritance, like that, you know, the things that my parents have passed down to me that left marks. And not scars, you know, like there's some things that's where they left marks and there's some places where they left scars, but that's true of mm-hmm. all parents and their children. Mm-hmm. And I like to think, you know, that I'm becoming the sum of the best parts of them now. And I had to learn to fall in love with myself. I had to learn to re-fall in love with my blackness. I had mm-hmm. to learn to fall in love with my queerness. I had to learn to fall in love with my artistry as a whole. And my humanity as a whole, and not just the convenient parts of myself. I had to really do the work to make sure that my spirit becomes non-perishable,
mm-hmm.
and that I'm not shaping myself to be, I'm not shaping my identity, my heart, and my psyche for other people's consumption. You know, that like that actually that I'm just trying to be the best version of myself and the kindest and most generous version of myself for me. And if other people get to benefit from that, then that's what's up.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not working to try to be anything for anyone else other than myself. I know that a person can only love another person to the depths in which they love themselves. And so my capacity for loving other people and subsequently creating work for other people is going to be a direct reflection of how much I love myself in a wholehearted way, not in a egotistical way.
Like,
you know, what are the most, you know, where are the undiscovered rooms in myself? Because if I am a human like, you know, the 7 or 8 billion other people on the planet, they probably feel the same, you know, they probably feel similar feelings. And how do I distill that to its core essence, its core humanity, and interrogate that and see what I find and then wrestle down onto the page, you know, those moments that I find. Or, you know, if I'm, you know, performing as an actor, how do I still find, like, you know, what are the parts of myself where I can be most generous, you know, that other people might, you know, see themselves reflected, and I'm able to amplify another writer's vision or my own vision if I'm doing my own work, which I've never done and scares the living daylights out of me to think about that, but I know that that's coming. So yeah, man, you know, we're all on a journey, and I'm just trying to figure out my own, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm psyched that our journeys crossed for a moment today, and then we got to talk for a little bit.
Yeah, this is cool, man.
Left a mark. Left a mark, not a scar. So
I'm trying, man.
So thank you for that.
Thank you, bro.
It was good talking to you.
Well, the pleasure's all mine.
Thank you, Lee, and thank you to Victory Gardens for giving us the time and space to have this conversation. Lee's play, The First Deep Breath, is running through December 22nd at Victory Gardens in Chicago. Go to victorygardens.org for tickets and information and all that stuff. Music from this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions. The theme song is High by International Pen Pal. The subtext is brought to you by American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group, and is produced and hosted by me. Thank you for listening. The play filling me up this month is Tidy by Christian Idashok. It's a fantastic solo play about what we keep and what we discard during a climate change-induced dystopia.